morning, and this is On the Air with Glenn Goebel, and we're on the air. How about that? Hey, we are going to, in this segment of our show, we're going to read the speech that Barack Obama gave as a memorial to John Lewis, who passed away, what was it, about a month ago, maybe a little more than that. And the speech is one of those speeches that I consider is kind of educational, and that's kind of what we do here on my program, both on, now that we've added Dr. Why am I struggling? Feynman. Now that we've added Dr. Feynman to our list of guests that comes on, he's going to be on every Wednesday on A Progressive Life. We may adjust having a swap shop and change it over to another afternoon with Progressive Life, just because, as you all know, because of the COVID virus, we don't get a lot of calls. We do get some, but not a lot of calls. We're looking forward to your call this afternoon after 12:15, 740-383-9944. But it's been a little slow, and we thought maybe we could pick it back up in the spring after everybody gets a shot. We're open for shots, right? All right. Well, anyway, I'm going to switch over, and I'm going to put on my actor's hat, my oral interp actor's hat, and I'm going to read through this Barack Obama speech about John Lewis's passing. All right. James wrote to his believers, "Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Let perseverance finish its works, so that you may be mature and complete, lacking in nothing. It is a great honor to be back in Ebenezer Baptist Church, in the pulpit of this greatest pastor, Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., to pay my respects to perhaps his finest disciple, an American whose faith was tested again and again to produce a man of pure joy and unbreakable perseverance, John Robert Lewis. To those who have spoken, to President Bush, Clinton, Madam Speaker, Reverend Warnock, Reverend King, and, I'm sorry, I will continue back. I forgot to turn the sound off on my phone. I am so sorry. All right, let's get back onto the John Robert Lewis eulogy. To those who have spoken, President Bush, Clinton, Madam Speaker, Reverend Warnock, Reverend King, John's family, friends, his beloved staff, Mayor Bottoms, I've come here today because I, like so many Americans, owe a great debt to John Lewis and his forceful vision of freedom. You know this country is a constant work in progress. We're born with instructions to form a more perfect union. Explicit in those words is the idea that we're imperfect. That what gives each new generation purpose is to take up the unfinished work of the last and carry it further than any might have thought possible. John Lewis, first of the freedom fighters, head of the Student Nonviolent Coordination Committee, youngest speaker of the March on Washington, leader of the March from Selma to Montgomery, member of Congress, representing the people of his state and this district of 33 years, mentor to young people, including me at the time. Until his final day on this earth, he not only embraced that responsibility, but he made it his life's work. which isn't bad for a boy from Troy. John was born into modest means. That means that he was poor. In the heart of the Jim Crow South, to parents who picked somebody else's cotton. Apparently, he didn't take on to farm work. On the days when he was supposed to help his brothers and sisters in their labor, he'd hide under the porch and make a break for the school bus when it showed up. His mother, Willie Mae Lewis, nurtured that curiosity in this shy, serious child. Once you learn something, she said, as a boy, once it gets inside of your head, no one can take it away from you. As a boy, John listened to those through doors after bedtime as his father and friends complained about the Klan. One Sunday, as a teenager, he heard Dr. King preach on the radio. As a college student in Tennessee, he signed up for the Jim Lawson's workshop on tactic of nonviolent civil disobedience. John Lewis was getting something inside his head, an idea he couldn't shake. It took hold of him that nonviolent resistance and civil disobedience were the means to change the laws, but also change the hearts and change the minds and change the nations and change the world. So he helped organize the Nashville campaign in 1960. He and other young men and women sat at a segregated lunch counter, well-dressed, straight-backed, refusing to let a milkshake poured on their heads or a cigarette extinguished on their backs or a foot aimed at their ribs, refused to let that dent their dignity and their sense of purpose. And after a few months, the Nashville campaign achieved the first successful desegregation of public facilities of any major city in the South. John got a taste of jail for the first, second, and third, well, several times. But he also got a taste of victory, and it consumed him with a righteous purpose, and he took the battle deeper into the South. The same year, just weeks after the Supreme Court ruled that segregation of interstate bus facilities was unconstitutional, John and Bernard Lafayette bought two tickets, climbed aboard a Greyhound, sat up front, and refused to move. This was months before the official Freedom Rides. He was doing a test. Trip was unsanctioned. Few knew what they were up to. And at every stop, through the night, apparently the angry driver stormed out of the bus and into the bus station. And John and Bernard had no idea what he might come back with or who he might come back with. Nobody was there to protect them. There were no cameras, crews, or records of the event. We, you know, sometimes, Reverend, we read about this and we kind of take it for granted. Or at least we act as if it was inevitable. Imagine the courage of two people younger than my oldest daughter on their own to challenge an entire infrastructure of oppression. John was only 20 years old. But he pushed all 20 of those years to the center of the table, betting everything, all of it, that his example would challenge centuries of convention and generations of brutal violence and countless daily indignities suffered by African Americans. Like John, the Baptist preparing the way, like the Old Testament prophets speaking truth to kings, John Lewis did not hesitate. And he kept on, getting on board buses and sitting at lunch counters. He got his mug shot taken again and again, marched again and again on a mission of Change America, spoke to 250,000 people at the March on Washington when he was just 23. helped organize the Freedom Summer in Mississippi when he was just 24. At the ripe old age of 25, John was asked to lead the march from Selma to Montgomery. He was warned that the Governor Wallace had ordered troops to use violence, but he and Hosea Williams and others led them across the bridge anyway, and we all have seen the film and the footage and the photographs. President Clinton mentioned the trench coat, the knapsack, the book to read, the apple to eat, the toothbrush. Apparently, jails weren't big on such creature comforts. And you look at those pictures, and John looks so young, and he's small in stature, looking every bit that shy, serious child that his mother had raised. And yet, he's full of purpose. God put perseverance in him. And we know what happened to the marchers that day. Their bones were cracked by billy clubs. Their eyes and lungs choked with tear gas. They knelt to pray, which made their heads easier targets. And John was struck in the skull, and he thought he was going to die. Surrounded by sight of young Americans gagging and bleeding and trampled. Victims in their own country of state-sponsored violence. And the thing is, I imagine initially that day the troopers thought they won the battle. You can imagine the conversations they had afterwards. You can imagine them saying, "Yeah, we showed them." They figured they'd turn the protesters back over the bridge, that they had persevered a system that denied the basic humanity of their fellow citizens. Except this time, there was some cameras there. This time, the world saw what happened, bore witness to the black Americans who were asking for nothing more than to be treated like other Americans, who were not asking for special treatment, just equal treatment, promised to them a century before and almost another country before. And when John woke up and checked himself out in the hospital, he would make sure the world saw a movement that was, in the words of Scripture, hard-pressed on every side, but not crushed, perplexed, but not despaired, persecuted, but not abandoned, struck down, but not destroyed. They returned to Brown Chapel, a battered prophet bandaged around the head, and he said, "More marchers will come now." And the people came, and the troopers parted, and the march reached Montgomery, and their words reached the White House. And Lyndon Johnson said of the South, "We shall overcome." And the Voting Rights Act was signed into law. The life of John Lewis was, in so many ways, exceptional. It vindicated the faith in our founding, redeemed that faith. That most American of ideas, the ideas that any of us, ordinary people, without rank or wealth or title or fame, can somehow point out the imperfections of this nation and come together and challenge the status quo and decide that it is our power to remake this country that we love until it is more closely aligns with our highest ideals. What a radical idea. What a revolutionary notion. That idea that any of us, ordinary people, a young kid from Troy, can stand up to the powers and the principalities and say, "No, this isn't right. This isn't true. This isn't just. We can do better." On the battlefield of justice, Americans like John, Americans like Lowry, Americans like C.T. Vivian, two other patriots we lost this year, liberated all of us that many Americans came to take for granted. America was built by people like them. America was built by John Lewis's. He, as much as anyone in our history, brought this country to a little bit closer to our highest ideals. And someday, when we do finish that long journey toward freedom, when we do form a more perfect union, whether it is years from now, or decades, or even if it takes another two centuries, John Lewis will be a founding father of that further, farther, better America. And yet, as exceptional as John was, here's the thing. John never believed that he was and that he had done more than any citizen of this country can do. I mentioned in the statement the day John passed, the thing about John was how gentle and humble he was. And despite that storied, remarkable career, he treated everyone with kindness and respect because it was innate to him. This idea that any of us can do what he did, if we are willing to persevere, he believed that in all of us there exists the capacity for great courage, that in all of us there is a longing to do what's right, that in all of us there is a willingness to love all people and extend to them their God-given rights. So many of us lose that sense. It's taught out of us. We start feeling as if, in fact, we can't afford to extend kindness or decency to other people. That we're better off if we above the other people and looking down on them. And so often that encouraged in our culture. But John always said he always saw the best in us. And he never gave up and never stopped speaking out because he saw the best in us. He believed in us even when we didn't believe in ourselves. And as a congressman, he didn't rest. He kept getting himself arrested. As an old man, he did sit out. He didn't sit out any fight. Sat in all night on the floor in the United States Capitol. I know his staff was stressed, but the testing of his faith produced perseverance. He knew that the march is not over, that the race is not yet won, that we have not yet reached the blessed destination where we are judged by the content of our character. He knew from his own life that progress is fragile, that we have to be vigilant against the darker currents of this country's history, of our own history, where there are whirlpools of violence and hatred and despair that can always rise again. Bull Connor may be gone, but today we witness with our own eyes police officers kneeling on the necks of black Americans. George Wallace may be gone, but we can witness our federal government sending agents to use tear gas and batons against peaceful demonstrators. We may no longer have to guess the number of jelly beans in a jar in order to cast a ballot. But even as we sit here, there are those in power who are doing their darndest to discourage people from voting by closing polling locations and targeting minorities and students with restrictive ID laws and attacking our voting rights with surgical precision. Even undermining the Postal Service in the run-up to an election that's going to be dependent on mail-in ballots so that people don't get sick. I know this is a celebration of John's life. There are some who might say we shouldn't dwell on such things, but that's why I'm talking about it. John Lewis devoted his time on this earth fighting the very attacks on democracy and what's best in America. And we're seeing it calculated right now. He knew that every single one of us has a God-given power and that the faith of this democracy depends on how we use it. The democracy isn't automatic. It has to be nurtured. It has to be tended to. We have to work at it. It's hard. And so he knew that it depends on whether we summon a measure, just a measure of John's moral courage to question what's right and what's wrong, and call things as they are. He said that as long as he had breath in his body, he would do everything he could to to preserve the democracy. And as long as we have breath in our bodies, we had to continue his cause. If we want our children to grow up in a democracy, not just with elections, but a true democracy, a representative democracy, and a big-hearted, torrent, vibrant, inclusive American of professional self, perpetual self-creation, then we're going to have to be more like John. We don't have to do all the things that he did do, because he did them for us. But we've got to do something. As the Lord instructed Paul, do not be afraid. Go on, speaketh. Do not be silent, for I am with you, and no one will attack you to harm you. And I have many in this city who are my people. It's just everybody's got to come out and vote. We've got all those people in the city, but they can't do nothing. Like John, we've got to keep getting into the good trouble. He knew that nonviolent protest is a patriotic as well as to raise public awareness and put a spotlight on injustice and make the powers that be uncomfortable. Like John, we don't have to choose between protests and politics. It's not an either-or situation. It's a both-and situation. We have engaged in protests where that's effective. But we also have to translate our passion and our causes into law, institutional practices. That's why John ran for Congress 34 years ago. Like John, we got to fight even harder for the most powerful tool that we have, which is the right to vote. The Voting Rights Act is one of the crowning achievements of our democracy. It's why John crossed that bridge, why he spilled that blood. And by the way, it was the result of a Democratic and Republican effort. President Bush, who spoke here earlier, and his father signed its renewal when they were in office. President Clinton didn't have to because it was law when he arrived. So instead, he made a law to make it easier for people to register to vote. But once the Supreme Court weakened the Voting Rights Act, some state legislators unleashed a flood of laws designed specifically to make voting harder, especially by the way state legislators were there a lot of minority turnout and population growth. That's not necessarily a mystery or an accident. It was an attack on what John fought for. It was an attack on our democratic freedoms. And we should treat it as such. If politicians want to honor John, and I'm so grateful for the legacy and the work of all the congressional leaders who are here, but there are better ways than a statement calling him a hero. You want to honor John? Let's honor him by revitalizing the law that he was willing to die for. And by the way, naming the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, that is a fine tribute. But John wouldn't want us to stop there, just trying to get back to where we were. Once we pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, we should keep marching to make it even better. By making sure every American is automatically registered to vote, including former inmates who've earned their second chance, by adding polling places and expanding early voting and making Election Day a national holiday. So if you are somebody who's working in a factory and you're a single mom who's got to go to a job and doesn't get time off, you can still cast your ballot. By guaranteeing that every American citizen has an equal representation in our government, including the American citizen who live in Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico. They're Americans. By ending some of the partisan gerrymandering so that all voters have a power to choose their politicians, not the other way around. And if all this takes eliminating the filibuster, another Jim Crow relic, in order to secure the God-given rights of every American, then that's what we should do. Now, even if we all do this, even if bogus voter suppression laws are struck off the books today, we've got to be honest with ourselves that too many of us choose not to exercise the franchise. Too many of our citizens believe that their vote won't make a difference, or that they buy into the cynicism that, by the way, is the central strategy of voter suppression, to make you discouraged, to stop believing in your own power. So we're also going to have to remember what John said. If you don't do everything you can do to change things, then they will remain the same. You only pass this way once. You have to give it all your all. As long as you're young, as the young people are protesting in the streets, hoping real change takes hold, I'm hopeful, but we can't casually abandon them at the ballot box. Not when few elections have been as urgent or so many levels as this one. We can't treat voting as an errand to run if we have some time. We have to treat it as the most important action we can take on behalf of our democracy. And like John, we have to give it all we have. I was proud that John Lewis was a friend of mine. I met him when I was in law school. He came to speak, and I went up to him and I said, "Mr. Lewis, you are one of my heroes. What inspired me more than anything as a young man was to see you and the Reverend Lawson and Bob Moses and Diane Nash and others and see what they did." And he got that kind of, "Aw, shucks, thanks for very much." Next time I saw him, I'd been elected to the United States Senate, and I told him, "John, I'm here because of you." And on Inauguration Day in 2008-2009, he was one of the first people I greeted and hugged on the stand. And I told him, "This is your day." He was a good and kind and gentle man, and he believed in us, even when we don't believe in ourselves. And it's fitting that the last time John and I shared a public forum was on Zoom. And I'm pretty sure neither he nor I set up the Zoom to call because we didn't know much about how to work it. It was a virtual town hall with a gathering of young activists who had been helping to lead the summer's demonstrations in the wake of the George Floyd's death. And afterwards, I spoke to John privately, and he could not have been prouder to see the new generation of activists standing up for freedom and equality, a new generation that was intent on voting and protecting the right to vote. In some cases, a new generation running for political office. And I told him, "All these young people, John, of every race and every religion, from every background and gender and sexual orientation, John, those are your children. They learn from your example, even if they didn't always know it." They had understood through him what American citizenship required, even if they'd only heard about his courage through the history books. By the thousands, faceless, anonymous young people, black and white, have taken our nation back to those great wells of democracy which are dug deep by our founding fathers in the formulation of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. Dr. King said that in 1960, and it came true again this summer, we see it outside our windows in big cities and in rural towns, in men and women, young and old, straight Americans and LGBTQ Americans, blacks who long for equal treatment, and whites who can no longer accept freedom for themselves while witnessing the subjugation of their fellow Americans. We see it in everybody doing the hard work of overcoming complacency, of overcoming our own fears and our own prejudices, our own hatreds. You see it in people trying to be better, truer versions of ourselves. And that's what John Lewis teaches us. That's where real courage comes from. Not from turning on each other, but by turning towards one another. Not by sowing hatred and division, but by spreading love and truth. Not by avoiding our responsibilities to create a better America and a better world, but by embracing those responsibilities with joy and preservation and discovering that in our beloved community, we can do not walk alone. What a gift John Lewis was. We are also lucky to have him walk with us for a while and show us the way. God bless you all. God bless America. God bless the gentle souls who pull us closer to this promise. Thank you very much. All right. Thank you for listening. And I know that was a little bit long. John Lewis was a great man. I think everybody agreed on that. I know very few people that would not agree to that, much like they would not say that Martin Luther King was not a great man. John Lewis was able to live his life leading that type of movement. Unfortunately, Dr. King was shot down in his youth. So we had to call on people like John Lewis to remind us what it was all about. I was lucky to have a father who marched in the Selma to Montgomery march. He was not one that was beaten by the police on the bridge. He was way back at the back. There were, I think, about 10 or 12 ministers from Indiana that went down to march with that march. But he wouldn't have been beaten because he was privileged. He was a white man. I'm sure they probably attacked some of the white men that were up front, but it's something that many of us, and I'm an older white man, many of us take for granted I'm talking about white men, that we're owed that sort of life, that we're owed all men are created equal. But the problem is, a lot of us older white men believe all men are created equal means all white men are created equal. So there are some still that believe it's all men and not including the women. And it's all white men. I think we've got to be a better country. And I'm not trying to throw stones at people. I think to be a better country, we have to figure out how we can all help each other out. You will not believe, and I've found this, I've been on a walk for 30 or 40 years to find and beat down my own prejudices. And it's hard. It really is hard. You start thinking very self-righteously. You think, oh, I've got it beaten. And then one of your friends who's a Chicano, right, or what, Hispanic, walks up to you, and you think, I don't know. You think he must be a restaurateur or something. You can't possibly be an American. Well, I've never quite gotten that bad, but we're all Americans. If you're an American, you're part of the fabric of this country, and if there's one hole in this fabric, the whole place starts to unravel. And we don't understand it yet. We're pretty bad about that. For some reason or other, we don't understand why all of us don't add to the goodness and the greatness of this country. When President Trump said, we're going to make America great again, I think he probably... didn't understand what had made us great to begin with. The Italians coming over a long time ago, the Irish coming over a long time ago, the Catholics coming over, people from South America coming north, the people from Africa being forced to come to the United States. They all built this fabric. They all created a little bit more American-ism. I think we should really relish this. I know you can enjoy this. You just have to let yourself forget your white privilege. You have to find a way to enjoy watching. I have friends that say, oh, you watch television and all you see is all these different faces and different religions and different sexual attitudes on TV, and it's disgusting. It is not disgusting. It's the beginning of a better country. And I'll tell you what, I'm going to try and avoid getting terribly political, but we need to find how important it is for your grandson to play basketball with a Hispanic kid right next to an Asian kid who gets a pass from an African-American kid. It is beautiful. And if you look at it, look at their smiles. Look at those little kids' smiles. They have no idea that that they're different, because they're not different. People are not different. People are people. We all have our idiosyncrasies. We all have, you know, some people, I don't know, some people might have a clubbed foot. Some people might have a broken nose that shows. Some people might have gray hair. Some people might have blue eyes. Some people might have brown eyes with black hair. There is no difference. We are all Americans, and we should be terribly proud that America is strong enough to gather us all together under one tent. For some reason or other, we don't seem to see that, but it is a fact. And you don't have to take my word for it. You know that I'm an agnostic. I am not much of a... I'm not what you would call a traditional Christian. But you don't have to take my word for all this. If you read your New Testament, Jesus tells all of you these things. And I'm not a minister, so don't expect me to go into a sermon about that, because I am definitely not a minister. My dad was, but I'm not. But if you don't believe me, read your New Testament. Read how the gentleman from a country other than yours Good Samaritan, helped the Samaritan, who is, you know, basically like our, I don't know, Muslim. Anyway, he was different, but he was the one that took care of his brethren who had been beaten by a robber. He wasn't saved by some high-up religion person. Matter of fact, they stood on the side and tried to walk around this beaten man. But, I got a little bit on my soapbox today. But I'm always going to get on my soapbox when it comes to race. I was lucky, and I think I've told you this before, I grew up in much of my younger years. We're in South Bend, Indiana, and the high school, junior high and high school that I went to was about a third African American. It was wonderful. There were African Americans I hated. There were also white kids I hated. There were we were all different. But we were all one. We were all South Bend Central Bears. And when it came right down to it, at the state championship, we were all Bears. Blue and orange were our colors. I think if you just search your heart, you will find out that we can all be far better to each other. And I know, it's kind of wimpy. People say if you're kind, if you're good to other people, you aren't tough. Well, to hell with being tough. I'm not tough. But I will be tough if people go against being kind to other people. I think that's what we have to do. And we have to be kind. And we have to be loving. I know the word's used an awful lot. I wish that we had seven versions of the word love like the Greeks have, but we don't. So we'll have to use the word love, and we'll have to say I love you to our friends, to our family, to the people we have no idea who they are, to the African American, to the Hispanic, to the Muslim. Say, or at least try, to put in that little pea brain that these people are people just like you. They have moms that love you just like your mom loves you. They're good people just like you. We are all good. We all can be good people if we will ignore what we were told and ignore all the hate that has been pushed down our throats for so many years. There should be no hate in the United States of America. The United States of America should love everyone in the United States of America, and therefore be loving to those outside. Well, anyway, that's
You're
enough.
Have a good day. Radio 107.1 FM LP Marion.